This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
This is Minnie interviewing Professor Martin van Kerkwijk from the University of Toronto. Hi, Martin.
Hello.
Could you tell us a little bit about your research?
I'd like to study dead objects.
Dead objects?
stellar corpses, and they're called white dwarfs and neutron stars. You probably have heard about neutron stars before if you have listened to this podcast ever. I'm sure there are a lot of people who study neutron stars and pulsars who feature in it. I'm interested in them both, in how they form, how they come about, and also in, because they're very extreme. They're both extremely dense. A white dwarf is sort of the mass of the sun in an Earth-sized object. A neutron star is a bit more than the mass of the sun in a city-sized object. And they're so dense, as particularly the neutron stars, that we don't really understand how stuff behaves if you compress it that much. And even, I do mostly observations, but my sort of underlying goal is to understand how these objects actually work.
I find that stuff so interesting. I mean, we always hear those sound bites, like, you know, a teaspoon of matter from a neutron star weighs like 200 million tons or something ridiculous like that.
The way I'd like to describe this as a bit more morbid one is that you take, if you take every human who ever lived and is alive today and all compress them in 1 cubic centimeter, you would have the density of a neutron star.
You weren't kidding when you said you liked studying dead things. That's really cool. So Professor Martin van Kerkwijk is actually giving our colloquium tomorrow, and I've been reading the abstract, and it sounds very interesting because it says that you're going to be able to do nano arcsecond astrometry. So did you want to tell us a little bit?
Sure. Partly why I'm visiting here, we had some earlier observations where Jodrell Bank was involved. We used a lot of telescopes on Earth. And the basic picture is much easier to explain with a drawing. What happens to radio waves that pulsars emit is that as they travel towards us, interstellar medium is not quite a vacuum. It's incredibly tenuous. But those radio waves of pulsars and any object really, they get very slightly delayed and also a little bit bent. And the net result of that is that if we look at the pulsar, we don't actually get only the emission that comes directly from the pulsar, but we got also things which came under with a slight delay, with a slightly long about wave. They sort of maybe went not quite in our direction, but very close to it. And then they got bent in the interstellar medium and then ended up in our dish anyway. And these radio waves, what they do is because they come with slight delays, they interfere with each other. And the net effect of that is that it's similar to what happens if you look at a star with your own eyes. You see that it sort of looks like it's changing its brightness. We call that twinkling of stars. These radio pulsars, the atmosphere does not very little to them, our own atmosphere, but in the interstellar medium, they have this bending too, and therefore they twinkle in the sense that as you look at them over time, then sort of every few minutes, they get brighter and fainter at a given frequency. At another radio frequency, which is very nearby, it would also get brighter and fainter, but not quite in the same way. Turns out, and we actually don't really understand why this is, that this bending of the light only happens at very particular locations in the space between us and the pulsar. You would think that it might just happen everywhere, but it doesn't. This is an observational fact for which there are theories, but certainly not everybody agrees. So the net effect is that you can think of it as we have a pulsar somewhere in the distance, very far away, then somewhere in between there is something which acts a little bit like a lens, and that's really what we're trying to use, which sort of bends light a little bit, and some of the light get actually bent the wrong way, but some towards us. That causes this, what we call scintillation, twinkling of the pulsar. Now, if we look with multiple telescopes on Earth, we can actually make pretty precise, very spatial resolving power, as if you had a dish which was as big as of order the Earth. You can see very sharply, not necessarily very sensitively, but at least very sharply.
So this is very long baseline interferometry?
That's right, yes. Right, and that's right. What Jodrell Bank partly does. That's partly why we used it. And that means you can sort of look at that pulsar, and what you see then is actually multiple images. You don't quite see just the one image directly from the pulsar, but you also see extra images where the light was bent a bit by the interstellar medium. We need actually quite a bit of trickery to do that. It's not quite as standard VLBI or very long baseline interferometry as one normally does, but I won't go into the trickery too much, but one can do that. It turns out that these images from the extra images, so basically from the lens, they're not sort of around the pulsar, they're only on both sides of a pulsar in a random orientation. So they form sort of a line on the sky, which is another puzzle that we don't really understand. But I mean, I think it's really interesting to find out why that is. But I really care mostly about the fact that there are discrete little images where the interstellar medium has sent the pulsar light towards us, and we can measure those. And now if by sort of looking at all these different images and really measuring what they see, we can almost treat them as if those images are telescopes in space, and that we, as if we have control over the telescope. So we can measure what the same as if we had real telescopes in space, which are just at those locations. And that those images on the sky, so if you, right, we have telescopes here on Earth, which are separated by thousands of kilometers. And we see these images, which are separated by, say, the distance of the Earth to the Sun. So what's called an astronomical unit. And these images are typically separated by an astronomical unit or a couple of astronomical units. And it's, so it is almost equivalent as if we had telescopes on Earth, on Mars, on Jupiter, a few on Saturn, maybe a few on the moons or a few in the asteroid belt.
So like
except
megas.
All on a line, which is a bit weird, but okay. And so you can sort of imagine that if we could do really well with telescopes spread over Earth, we're already very happy. We get sort of milli-arc-second precision measurements, that if you spread them even further all through your solar system, basically, and that's sort of the spatial scales we're talking about, then you can get millions of times better resolution. So you get this nano-arc-second precision measurements. That's sort of the overall goal that you're trying to reach. And it has sort of been done, not by me actually, but partially by a colleague who was in Australia and is now in the United States, Walter Briskin, and then a colleague of mine in Toronto, Wally Penn, has... Walter Briskin did it from Earth and sort of showed that, oh, these images, they're all on a line and they're sort of separated by some astronomical units. And then my colleague Wally Penn went a step further to say, now I can use this to look at with really high resolution at the pulsar. And we're trying to now make this a bit more common and in some sense do scientifically more interesting studies with it. The one that they did was quite nice, but it didn't answer a question that was maybe particularly fantastic.
That's very interesting. So essentially, instead of very long baseline interferometry, you're doing extremely mega very, I mean, we were saying, I think in the October extra, yeah, that astronomers quite often have very uncreative names for our telescopes. Yes. Very long baseline, extremely long baseline.
That's right.
What would you call this then?
I would call it interstellar baseline.
Brilliant. I love it. So I have lots of questions, yeah, for you. I always thought that scintillation was due to our own ionosphere, and I suppose that's probably true for stars. So what makes pulsars scintillate? Like, why don't stars scintillate due to the ISM?
So the two reasons. One is, it depends what you mean by star. As you see it by your eye, then they don't scintillate because the interstellar medium is not dense enough to bend the light of a star much at all.
Oh, because optical.
Yeah,
right.
But there's another reason, which is in some sense also related to that you can actually tell if you look by eye at the sky which is a planet and which is a star.
Right.
Because planets don't twinkle.
Right, because they're bigger in the sky.
That's right, they're bigger in the sky, and therefore different parts of the planet go through different parts of the atmosphere, and each of those in principle twinkles, but because you have so many different parts, you sort of cancel out all the twinkling. Some go up, some go down, and that cancels out. Now the same goes for this radio scintillation. If your radio source is too big, you would get many different paths and they would actually not scintillate.
Right.
And basically because the scale for that is the same nano arc second, so anything that's bigger than, say, 200 nano arc seconds on the sky as seen from us, which is typical distance, we're talking maybe 10,000 kilometers or so, and a pulsar is really nicely smaller than
right.
that. But most other objects are quite a lot bigger than 10,000
right, right.
kilometers. Those wouldn't twinkle.
So compact radio objects do scintillate, I know.
Yeah,
people,
that's right. And
yeah.
So then, in some sense, the same kind of thing, that you have something which is actually quite small, and in that case it's also, well, it may actually be 10,000 kilometers, but it's much further away than
right.
the pulsar. So in sort of the angle on the sky, it is really quite small, and that's why those extra galactic sources also can scintillate.
But they're scintillating because of the ionosphere or because of the ISM?
They also scintillate because of the ISM. There is also effects due to our Earth's ionosphere.
Okay.
And I'm sort of usually assuming that we understand more or less, so that's taken out. I'm not worrying about that.
Okay.
You have to worry about it if you're actually doing the measurements, and the interstellar part is sort of the new part.
Right. And so with this interstellar very long baseline interferometry?
On an interstellar scale, is it near? Maybe it would be the interstellar small baseline interferometer.
The interstellar small baseline interferometry. This is something that you can only do with pulsars because they're so compact.
That's right.
But does that also mean you can only study pulsars with this technique?
Yeah, so maybe one could, in principle, as you said, there are some extragalactic sources, so maybe one could study those too. That's actually harder because pulsars have the advantage that they have these regular pulses of radio emission, and we use that in part to help us understand how this scintillation pattern works. But
oh,
in
I
principle,
see.
those extragalactic sources one could do two, but basically, yes, at some level, one is limited to what happen to be the most interesting objects in the universe, so it's not so bad. Well, one of the most interesting.
I think you might be a little biased, but pulsars are very interesting. So the other thing I saw that you're going to be talking about in the colloquium tomorrow are these giant pulses.
Right.
And so if I, again, I think I told you, I'm not a pulsar astronomer. Yeah. I basically understand you've got this very compact object, it's rotating, you see the beam of, you know, particles. But how often do you get giant pulsars? What causes them?
So most pulsars, as you said, the standard picture of a lighthouse. There's something turning around, and the beam of the lighthouse, if it goes towards you, you see a pulse of emission coming by. And some pulsars sometimes emit much brighter pulses, which are with thousands of times brighter. So for the object that we've been studying, normally in any given rotation, we just barely detect that there is a little peak, and we just add many of them together and we get a nice signal. But those ones are just completely obvious, those giant pulses, and they come, but not many pulsars don't do this. Some do. The Crab pulsar, one of the first ones, is a very famous example. Actually, that's one which is so extreme that it almost only emits giant pulses, and then for a long time you don't see anything, and then another giant pulse. And our pulsar is a bit more in between, I guess, in that it shows these maybe every few seconds. It has one giant pulse. Now, this pulsar rotates incredibly fast. It rotates around its axis 600 times per second.
Wow.
So normally you get, actually, for every few thousand regular pulses, you get one which really stands out. And it's quite clear. It's not just that, oh, this was a bit unusually bright. It really stands out.
Right. So,
and they're very, very short, which is really, really, really sort of interesting.
So you said they happen every few thousand rotations. So it's doing a giant pulse every few seconds.
Well, that's the ones we see, of course, right? It might be doing many more of them, which happen to go in the wrong way and we don't see them.
What do you mean by in the wrong way?
Well, they're usually emitted maybe quite in some direction, and it doesn't happen not to go towards us.
Wow. So do you have any idea what causes the giant pulses?
There are ideas about it, but I think they're very vague. I hope actually at some level our observations can help maybe understand them a bit. One thing that our observations did help show is that they're really, really short. And so we did that in part actually using that interstellar medium, because the light follows different paths. So some paths take a little bit longer. So this is one of those things that I find quite intriguing. So to tell you sort of how little the interstellar medium at some level does. So this pulsar is 2 kiloparsecs, or about 6,000 light years away. So the light takes 6,000 years from the pulsar to come to us. And then these little detours that a bit of the light makes by going through the interstellar medium, on that 6,000 years, it adds maybe 10 microseconds or so at most.
Really? Wow.
So it's a very, very short additional delay. But nonetheless, these pulses themselves, the giant pulses, are actually much shorter than that. And so at some level, it's as if you take a little flash photograph of that interstellar medium, and you can sort of see the light that came directly from the pulsar, and then maybe a bit which came a bit later, and another bit which came a bit later yet. And we see that pattern is exactly the same as long as the giant pulses are very close together. And from that, we can actually tell that these giant pulses intrinsically, we mean they arrive over microseconds because of the interstellar medium, but intrinsically, they're less than 200 nanoseconds long. So they're really, really short duration, in which suddenly the pulsar is very bright, takes a very short time, and then it's off again. But I mean, to get back to your original question, do we understand what happens? Really, the answer is no.
Right. Yeah. So how long is a normal pulse?
So a normal pulse, this is a very fast pulsar, so it goes 600 times around its axis each second. And then the normal pulse, it has actually two components. One which is fairly bright and it lasts maybe, one this is fairly long and it lasts maybe 0.4 milliseconds. And then there's a shorter and brighter component, which is more of a peak that lasts, well, what would it be? Maybe 0.1 milliseconds or so. But so that is in nanoseconds, that would be, 100,000 nanoseconds.
Right.
So these giant pulses are much, much shorter than that.
So in my naive view of a pulsar, I was under the impression that pulsars, one of the reasons they're so interesting is because they're they're so regular.
Right.
Their pulses occur at the same time.
Yeah.
And I thought that their relative, I guess, strength of each pulse was relatively similar and duration was relatively similar. So these things are really, like,
they're
anomalies.
Yeah, it is not quite true that every pulse always looks so similar. But if you've added maybe 30 or 100 pulses together, then you have something which is really stable, which
right.
is what people use for the timing. It is actually, in some sense, a little bit, I mean, in some sense, maybe it's good that the giant pulses occur relatively frequently, but they would throw one off a little bit. But then again, many pulsars don't have these giant pulses.
What fraction of pulsars have giant pulses?
Well, I think we have to be a little bit careful which fraction has to be found. I think there. So there's the crab, our what's called the black widow pulsar. That's ours. And there's another rapidly spinning pulsar, so that's three. And I think there's one more. So it's a handful.
Oh, I see.
Of the thousands of pulsars that we know.
Can I ask a non-scientific question?
Yes.
I noticed that, you know, you refer to the crab pulsar and the black widow pulsar.
Yes.
Is there a thing with naming pulsars after eight-legged creatures?
Actually, the two are unrelated, but it is a funny thing that you ask. So the crab pulsar is named after the crab supernova remnant.
Right.
And that is because it sort of looks vaguely crab-like in an optical image.
And it's beautiful.
And it's a really beautiful image, that's right. And actually, again, it's one of, if you've never seen it, look at the crab pulsar, the movie, or something like that, Googling it will be fine. It actually changes, which is unusual for anything in astronomy. Usually things don't change on a human time scale. And this particular one, the black widow pulsar, is called that way. So this one has a companion. It's in a binary with a very low mass star. And this pulsar, it rotates very fast. And this particular one is also losing quite a lot of energy. The pulsar is spinning down and emitting a lot of radiation, which is in sort of, the companion orbits this pulsar in about 9 hours. So it's quite close to it. And because this pulsar is emitting so much energy, the part of the companion that is facing the pulsar gets heated a lot. So that companion itself, when it was discovered, the term didn't exist yet. We would now, at least by its mass, call it a brown dwarf. So it doesn't have much nuclear fusion itself in its core, and it's not very luminous. On its dark side, away from the pulsar, it's maybe 2500 degrees, which is, of course, by terrestrial standards, quite hot. Celsius or Kelvin, that doesn't really matter in this case. But on the side facing the pulsar, it's about as hot as the sun.
Oh, wow. 6000 degrees-ish.
That's right. So it's more than two times as hot. And the other thing that we observe is that if the pulsar is sort of, it doesn't completely get covered by the companion, but if it's behind the companion, then in some radio frequencies it dims quite a lot. So there is something coming off the companion, and which is probably related to it being heated so much by the pulsar. There's some stuff is leaving the companion, some kind of wind of stellar material, at a relatively large rate. And at least initially when they found the system, they thought it was such a large rate that if you waited a billion years or so, the companion would be completely gone. That actually, we no longer think that, but that is why it was called the Black Widow pulsar,
because it's eating
it had a mate, and it's actually not eating it, but it's sort of blasting it apart. But we now, from further measurements, we realize that's not quite true. It will stay there, but it will get ever more tenuous. I mean, it will stay there for quite a while. More than a billion.
That
years.
Really is quite macabre. That's
yes.
an awesome name.
Yes. That,
but aren't there a lot of, I guess, millisecond pulsars or like pulsars that are in binary systems that are also, I guess, cannibalizing or...
Yeah, so there are quite a lot of, in fact, many of these very rapidly rotating neutron stars are in binaries. And we think that is because at some point their companion, not just... Before it was a pulsar, the companion might have, because it neared the end of its life, might have become bigger and donated some of the material to the pulsar by becoming too big. And at some point, the material closest to the pulsar sort of doesn't know anymore, hey, I'm actually don't really belong to this companion anymore. I want to go to the pulsar. And because of all that matter landing on the pulsar, they can make them spin faster again. So many of the most rapidly spinning pulsars have binary companions. Most of those companions are stellar corpses themselves, so that they're stars that they maybe lost some matter to the pulsar and now they're white dwarfs. So that's partly why I got interested in white dwarfs, actually. But you're right, there are also quite a few which have So after, this system was the original Black Widow pulse. And we now know more of similar systems. And we know also some systems where the companion is still a more or less normal star. And it's where the pulsar is not heating it as much. And because we're talking spiders anyway, those have been dubbed redbacks.
Oh, brilliant! Yeah.
And the companions actually, in the way they are, if you could see them in visual light, they would be slightly reddish. So this is also appropriate. They're a bit colder than the sun, so they're not yellow, but more orange reddish.
I guess because of what you're doing, you're looking at very compact areas and very extreme environments. I also understand that with these, you can probe some fundamental physics. Can you tell us a little bit about
that? Right, so that is the main thing that sort of goes back to the original thing that, right, we come effectively in a neutron star, whatever what remained of the star that formed it in the supernova explosion is compressed to really high densities. I mean, it's called a neutron star because it's mostly made out of neutrons, of course. And basically the nuclei in the matter that formed it have been compressed so much that it's almost as if you have one giant nucleus. And so near sort of down to halfway the neutron star, we sort of think that we know how matter behaves. But if you go further down in the neutron star, things have been compressed more and more, and it's denser and denser. And the question is, well, what actually happens if you take mostly neutrons and you squeeze them closer and closer together? We know from particle physics that neutrons are made up of quarks, three quarks each, and you can sort of imagine that if you could compress them infinitely far, these quarks wouldn't know anymore whether they belong to each other in one neutron or whether they belong to the next neutron. So from theory, we know that if you compress it to near infinite density, it must become a quark soup.
Right.
A very dense quark soup, that is. But in between, we don't really know what happens, and that is just where neutron stars are. And so the hope is that by measuring the properties of neutron stars, we can sort of work backwards and say, well, what really happens if I squeeze neutrons to sort of 10 times the density that they have in a nucleus? And so what people do is people have different ideas of how it should behave. And if you then, so this particular pulsar is interesting for the following reason, that if you take these different theories of neutrons, how they would behave if you squeeze them denser and denser, one of the things you get out is that if you take one theory, it would predict that if you make a neutron star more and more massive, so you squeeze it more and more, at some point it's going to form a black hole.
Right.
It can't handle it anymore. And that at some point depends on how you think the center of the neutron star actually behaves. And so different theories make different predictions. And it used to be, and then we can compare with observations. So it used to be that, for instance, the most simple-minded theories you could come up with predicted that a neutron star could be no more massive than 0.7 times the mass of the sun. Now that's the moment the first neutron star mass was determined, it was 1.4, so that theory was crossed out. But really, people knew that theory was too simple. But the 1.4 was basically at a level where almost everything else was still okay. Everything that was not really too simple, we know that doesn't work, was still okay. Now, the last few years, there have been two neutron stars found which have a mass of 2 times the mass of the sun. And that excluded about 3/4 of all the theories that existed. Now, there are lots of theories, sadly. but anyway, now this particular Black Widow pulsar measurements that I actually made of its companion sort of suggest that the mass is 2.4 solar masses. But we're basically not quite sure. And the thing that is missing is that we don't quite know how the system is oriented relative to us in space. So you can imagine that if you're completely aligned with the orbital plane, the two objects would go right in front of each other. So that would be one orientation. And you could imagine another orientation where you're looking from the top down on the binary, where just they go around in the sky. Well, we know that neither of those is correct, because we see that the objects don't completely go in front of each other, and we see the objects move along the line of sight, so right. We know they can't be from Poland. And so what people have done to measure how it's oriented is they actually took the fact that this companion is so heated by its pulsar and said, well, there's one half that's really strongly heated and one half that's dark. I can sort of model that and then say, okay, if we look in optical light, we actually see at some time when the bright side of the pulsar is towards us, so when the pulsar is between us and the companion, we see it quite bright, and on the other side we see hardly anything. Can make a model for that, and that gives then what the angle is between the plane of the orbit and how we're looking at it. Now, if I trust, and I didn't do that particular modeling myself, If I trust that, then I get this 2.4 solar masses. Right. But if I think, well, maybe, I don't know that I trust that model so much. Maybe the pulsar is, yes, it's heating the companion on one side, but there's some strong winds on the surface so that the backside gets a little bit hotter than I really thought in my model. Then it changes the answer. So that's really bad, right? You want to have the real answer. And what we hope to do with, now this is makes the circle complete, what we hope to do with this interstellar short baseline interferometer is that we can actually see the neutron, because we have such incredibly high precision, we should be able to see the pulsar move on the sky.
Right.
And we know that the orbit itself is circular. So if we can see how it looks like in projection, then only if we would look right from the top, it would look like a circle on the sky. Well, we know that is not true. While if we look really from the edge, it would look a line on the sky, right? It would just go zigzag. And if it's somewhere in between, it would look like an ellipse. And by measuring how elliptical it is, we would get the inclination, and nobody could argue about that. That would be the right answer. So that's sort of the goal of the observations, but we haven't gotten there yet. I should be very clear.
Oh, I'm very interested in when you guys get the results. So you said this thing is 6,000 light years away.
Yeah.
And typically, neutron stars are of order a few tens of kilometers across.
That's right.
And you're planning on being able to see kind of the structure on...
Yeah, no, that seemed quite... No, remember, we're not seeing quite the neutron star itself.
But the orbit.
But the orbit, and the orbit is about 10,000 kilometers.
Still.
That is incredible, yes.
Yeah, that's crazy. I mean, I deal with, like, kiloparsecs to megaparsecs. Right. To be thinking about looking down on, like, thousands of kilometer scales. Right. Something 6,000 light years away.
Yeah,
that's very cool.
Right.
That is very cool. So another thing that I'd never thought about until just chatting to you now, I always just assumed, you know, neutron stars were, you know, just a ball of neutrons. Yeah. But of course, what you're saying is there are different densities as this goes on. How does one measure, I suppose, is there there must be an evolution of neutron stars. And how would you measure the density of neutron stars? You can go white dwarf to neutron star to black hole. Yeah. But, you know, this is a continuum, presumably. Yeah.
No, so ideally you would in fact measure the sort of density in different places and just look at the matter directly. You can't. So, I mean, and what I'm trying to do is only measure a mass, and I look at the sort of the limit of how big it could be. Ideally you would measure the radius too, but
right. So
people have thought of different ways of doing that, and the main way is basically look actually at different neutron stars in other types of binaries, where you actually do throw some matter on the neutron star, and you see then the neutron star gets very bright because this matter falls towards the neutron star with about a third of the speed of light. So when it hits the surface, it gets really hot, so that heats the neutron star up a bit, and then that is very difficult to model, but we see it's getting very bright, get very hot, and then at some point that stops, and then you basically see the neutron star cool. We say, okay, well, if we now measure how much flux it emits, and we know for some neutron stars we know the distance fairly well, we measure how hot it is, we can work out in principle what the radius should be.
Right.
And so people have measured the radii that way. And here again, that is just the in principle measurement, because what one usually, for a given temperature, do you really know how much flux is emitted? We know it approximately. We use a black body formula that's developed by Planck 100 years ago. It's probably not quite right. We make a model that should be a bit better. Do we know it for sure? Well, I would say no. But what this has helped already is, right, we may not to the level that we really would like, but it does show that the radii are indeed 10 or maybe 15 kilometers. So, but it's just that we don't know exactly what it is, and we would need to know it more precisely to really tell what happens inside the neutron star.
This is all mind-blowing for me. I was very excited just by the Event Horizon Telescope, which is planning on using VLBI, but at high frequencies, so they get the really high spatial resolution.
That's right.
But to do this with pulsars and to sort of probe our own galaxy with this kind of precision is really insane. I have another question, which again is probably outside of normal pulsar astronomers, but if giant pulses are so powerful, does that mean you can see pulsars outside of our own Milky Way?
Possibly. People have the brightest ones that we know of come from the Crab pulsar, and those in principle we should probably be able to see in our nearest galaxy, say the Andromeda galaxy. People have looked for it, not quite found it. I must say, I'm not completely sure whether one would have almost seen it or whether you would have seen something that's a bit brighter than a crab. I don't remember that. But what what some people at least do think is that the fashion in astronomy, also in astronomy with fashion, with really sort of weird things that are really not understood, and then everybody of course wants to help understand them. But so it's a fashion in a good sense, I think, and those are called fast radio bursts. So some from random direction in the sky, we get sometimes these flashes of radio emission which seem to come from really quite far away. That's about the only constraint we have, and one of the maybe in some sense the simplest model for them is that they are in fact sort of ultra strong analogs of these, so they're super giant pulses, right? We have to add another super or maybe hyper.
Amazing acronyms.
Yes, that's right. So that would be one possibility, that they are pulsars like the Crab pulses. And so that we, in fact, if that's the case, the answer to your question would be yes. We would be able to see them elsewhere, but we don't know that for sure yet. And there's certainly, I think it is still correct to say, I think we have now maybe 24 of these fast radio bursts, and we have about 10 times more theoretical ideas of what they are really due to.
I keep hearing people say that there are more theories than there are FRBs right now. But FRBs are pretty much one of the hottest topics in modern astronomy right now.
Yeah, at least for radio astronomy.
Right.
Yes.
Are there any other type of astronomer?
Well, there are people who look for planets around other stars.
I don't understand. Well, that's really exciting. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us on this podcast.
Well, thank you for having me.
And I'm really excited about the colloquium tomorrow.
Okay.
So thank you very much. And that was Professor Martin von Kerkleit from the University of Toronto.
Yep.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you.